Good evening. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dip. At this time, we begin the TechNet as we do most Sunday evenings for the last 32 years, I think it is, 33 years, something like that. 1982, 34 years. This will be TechNet number 1639. You'll also be hearing Space Report number 239. The TechNet is a gathering of the curious radio amateurs who want to know more about how radio equipment works, how to make it work better. There's 26 or so different kinds of ham radio. 2-meter repeater ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of the 26. Arguably, this is one of the most educational hobbies that you can easily get hold of. And if you're displeased with this hobby, before you completely give it up, try one of the other 25 kinds, is my recommendation. As I said, the TechNet gathers people who are curious, and that's how mankind usually makes the most amount of progress, out of curiosity. The group in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area, let's see, that's a tri-state area, gather and help each other. We take check-ins by way of you giving me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in just because you're listening. After 34 years, we believe somebody is listening. Try to remember to listen for the 3 beeps in between each transmission to make sure that the repeater gets completely reset like this. It's actually 4 beeps. And if you jump the gun too fast before the 4 beeps come along, there's a chance that the machine will time out and portions of what you're saying will not be heard. Okay, at this time we're going to take check-ins. If you've got a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and name right now. K2IW listening.
WHYY, Joe, yes.
This is KC2 Queen Yankee Whiskey. The name here is Joe number 2, and yes.
So far we've got Joe number 1 and Joe number 2. Anyone else to check in with a question or a comment? Give me a call with a name right now.
This is KC2 MTC. Echo.
Hello, Delta 2, Mike Tango Papa, I think it was, by Echo Link. Please give me your name, sir.
Sorry about that. The name is Andy. KD2MTP.
Very fine. Andy, and when you come back, when we get to you, you can give us a little bit more audio by speaking a little louder. Alrighty, anyone else to check in? Give me a call letters and name right now.
WS2N, Paul, with a space report. Good evening, Dick.
Good evening, Paul. We'll soon be giving us space report number 239. Anyone else to check in? Because you do have a question or a comment, please give me your call letters right now. Okay. The first guy to check in was Joe number 1, WA2RYY. Go right ahead, Joe. Wait for the beeps.
Okay. Interesting subject you talked about last week or so about having. Attenuates in cabling on an antenna system. In case of you, it was multi-cables gave you the problem. But I'd like to talk about that a little more and find out if you have a system where you have, say, 2, 3, or 4 dB of attenuation in a cable or suspected cable, would that tend to, I believe that would tend to add to your return loss reading and make it actually look better than it actually is. My question is, would that type of response viewed on the proper instrumentation tend to give you a broader, flatter response when only a slight dip negative return loss at the actual resident frequency, or do you think that would not happen? Back to you.
Yeah, let's go step by step as to what really causes what's called return loss. If this is the best of all worlds and you've got a pure 50 ohm coaxial cable and a pure 50 ohm load at the far end, all the signal going down that cable will get transferred to that load, none of it comes back. If the load is anything but 50 ohms resistive, if it's 49 ohms or 51 ohms resistive, if it's 50 ohms resistive with 10 ohms of capacitor reactance, if it's anything else, a predictable amount of signal that goes down the cable that hits the load, a predictable amount will reflect from the load at a predictable phase angle of reflection, once you know what the exact impedance of the load is. That reflected signal is going to come back down the cable. It's going to literally transfer itself through the cable a second time. The forward going signal with some insertion loss and the reflected signal with some insertion loss. When you make measurements of return loss or apparent standing wave ratio in the shack, because of the loss of the cable, the signal going up got a little bit of loss, the signal coming back got a little bit of loss, therefore the amount of signal returning to you in the shack is going to be lower than it would be if the cable was lossless. Let me drop. Therefore, the apparent standing wave ratio will be better. And if your definition of bandwidth of your system is the lower frequency and the upper frequency where it hits 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, and 2-to-1 standing wave ratio is roughly a 10 dB reflection coefficient. The signal coming back is roughly 1/10 of the signal going out if you really have a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio at the antenna. But if your cable had, let me pick a number, 3 dB of loss, the signal going out got 3 dB of loss, the signal coming back got 3 dB of loss, therefore a real 2-to-1 load with a real 10 dB reflection coefficient will look like a 16 dB reflection coefficient. A 2-to-1 standing wave ratio at the antenna will look something like a 1.5-to-1 standing wave ratio in the shack because of the double loss of the cable effect of a signal going out and coming back. So if your definition of bandwidth of your antenna system is where it hits 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, you now have to go to a considerably wider frequency. You may need in my example, you would need a 4 dB reflection coefficient from the antenna in order to see a 10 dB reflection coefficient in the shack, and therefore you think you're measuring a greater bandwidth. It's not real. So you get a double error. Let me drop. So when you make a standing wave ratio measurement in the shack, you see a better standing wave ratio than is real. You'll see what you think is greater bandwidth than is real. But that's if you're naive. If you know because you've looked up your particular cable and you know that that many feet of your cable at that frequency has 3 dB of loss, if you measure a 10 dB reflection coefficient in the shack and you know the cable's got 3 dB of loss and the signal got lost twice, you know that the real signal is not 10 dB reflection coefficient, it's really a 4 dB reflection coefficient. You'll subtract the double insertion loss when you make the measurement in the shack if you're smart enough. So you can compensate for the known insertion loss of the cable. Life gets a little bit more complicated if you've jumped between various cable impedances. If some of that cable is 50 ohms and some of the cable is 70 ohms, the junction between those two cables at that point of junction makes a reflection coefficient. So now you've got a double reflecting going on. You've got a reflection of where the junction of the two cables occurred. Let me drop. That's giving you some signal that gets back down to the shack. The real load and its mismatch is giving you some signal that gets down to the shack. And those two reflected signals could be in phase or out of phase. And therefore, their apparent signal strength measured in the shack, the reflected signal, can be stronger or weaker because of that double. But that's the more complicated case. The simple case is a cable was lost, you make the measurements in the shack, you get this double error of lower visoir than reality, greater bandwidth than reality in general, but you can compensate for it mathematically if you know the loss of your cable. And therefore, you can make believe that your instrumentation is really mounted at the antenna if you truly know the loss of your cable. To me, 2LYY. I wonder if it makes it a little bit more clear, Joe. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, say the antenna was supposed to have we'll pick a number, a minus 20 dB return loss at center frequency by itself. Your transmission line is supposed to have 1 dB of insertion loss. You're using a jumper between the hard line and the antenna itself that might be some of the cable, 50 ohms of course, but it has maybe a quarter of a dB loss. So in the case of that, when you know all these losses, you would expect to see a certain pattern on the return loss coming back. Now say you have this thrown into the equation. Water has gotten into your jumper, between the jumper and the hard line, between the antenna and the hard line, and now that insertion loss, instead of being 0.25 decibels loss, maybe it's 3 decibels of loss, additional loss in your system. What would your return loss look like? Would it be a linear type of effect across the whole frequency sweep of the antenna, say if it's, you're sweeping 440 to 450 or 430 to 450, or would it tend to give you a more flattened out response because you're adding insertion loss, additional insertion loss of 3 decibels in both directions? Back to you.
Most of the time, water in a cable, I'm talking about foam-filled cable with water in the foam, which most of the time will not show up on your ohm meter when you measure center conductor to shield, and the insertion loss is an RF loss, the signal flowing down that cable has to go through that waterlogged foam, and it's going to experience extra loss. In that example I just gave you, let's assume now that the water is creating, like your example, 3 dB of loss. It's almost identical to putting a 3 dB attenuator in the cable. You wouldn't know the difference. There is another way. If you've now got air-filled Andrew Heliacs, and there's a portion of your cable that is horizontal, maybe it's a loop around the rotator, or a portion of it's horizontal, and you've got a pool of water bridging the gap between the center conductor and the shield where normally there's air. In that particular case, your ohm meter will definitely show you not infinity between center conductor and shield. You might see 50,000 ohms. In that particular case that I just described, the cable now is a much more complicated structure. Not only does it have a hell of a lot more insertion loss, but in the portions where water is pooled between center conductor and shield, in that area, the cable is not 50 ohms. It might be 37 ohms, so to speak. And because the water, your signal is now entering the tapered section where there's a pool of water, and so the cable is slowly changing in impedance. The signal is slowly changing in impedance as it hits the section of water. So water in the cable. Is it a pool of water in air-filled cable? Is it water in full cellular, full closed cell foam? When you got it, let me drop it.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The best situation is the water in the foam. Pure insertion loss. No real change in standing wave ratio. The cable is still 50 ohms, but now it's a very lossy cable. And whenever the cable has extra loss, whether it's because you put an attenuator in the cable, whether there's a waterlogged piece of cable with the foam, water in the foam, or because you've added an extra length of cable, which created more insertion loss, as long as the cable stays 50 ohms and it's got an extra insertion loss, then you can predict very nicely what the measurement in the shack appears to be, and you can correct. Assuming now you put your bird watt meter at the top of the cable, at the top of the tower, and then put a known amount of power in at the bottom, and you really measure the insertion loss of that cable, you now know how to compensate. So the most insidious situation is where you believe you know the loss of the cable because you've looked it up in the manufacturer's sheet, and you assume the cable has no loss in the phone, but it really has loss. You're now going to be measuring very desirable sounding standing wave ratios, which may not be real. I've tried to measure whether or not cable has water in the phone. Let me drop it.
And QGZ.
QGZ.
I've tried, QGZ and EJ recognize, I've tried to make measurements at the bottom of the cable, hardline cable, which I thought was getting water in it, in the phone, to try to detect whether or not the water is there. It's a very difficult measurement. Without making an end-to-end measurement, you can't really confirm the water is there. And without knowing the extra insertion loss due to the water, you don't know how to...
Hey, good evening, WBQ. So, a couple of things. With transmission line, like, you know, any what do you want to call it, hermetically sealed line on the outside, if you want to call it that. In other words, the solid copper line, not superflex. You know, one way or another, it's going to have a top and a bottom. So what normally happens with that is the if you get water in there somehow, it's going to stay on the outside of the foam, between the foam and the shield on the inside, and propagate through the line down to the bottom, end up filling up the connector and giving you a measurable bad return loss, non-50 ohm, big distance default hit. That's the failure 85% of the time with those lines, right? Where you start getting the water in the foam, and you can see the water in the foam, are things like a Belden 8214, where that foam can sop up water in there. And what I recently did with a line that was in place for a while, was not necessarily protected well, wanted to see how it was going to behave, is I just shot it to an open. I took the connector off, I looked at the return loss and divided it in half. I mean, so that's the most effective way to evaluate your antenna system. If you can get up top, is just open the end and see what your return loss is, divided by two. And that's your one-way insertion loss. If that's in the realm of what you think the cable should be based on the manufacturer's spec, you can say, well, that's okay. You will not find it with the distance default, typically. I mean, you can go up to the top and you see the phone's all green, cut it back 10 feet and see what you see. But generally, with those cables, with that kind of foam that'll suck up water, once they're done, they're done.
Rather good information, Bill. That makes sense. So a puddle of water right at a connector is going to give you a lot of grief. I've had water fall into the center of a type-in connector at the top of the tower. And to take apart the assembly and mop up the water and make sure that you've better sealed it so water can't get in there again is the right approach, hoping the water didn't propagate further down in the cable. In my naive days, lots of years ago, where I had a 700-watt output transmitter at 432, I said, well, if there's water there, I'll just boil it away as if it's a microwave oven. I'll put 700 watts through the cable for a while, and I'll boil away the water that's in the type-N connector. Bad move. Doesn't work. Don't do it. So, and water crawling down the outside of the foam, if the water didn't gather at the connector, but water crawled down the outside of the foam, between the foam and the outer conductor, outer jacket of a rigid cable, semi-rigid cable, it could give you a considerable increase in insertion loss, but it's a distributed loss. It's not going to show up on a time domain reflectometer per se. It's not going to show up on an ohmmeter test, and yet it's giving you extra loss. And so opening up the end of the cable and measuring the return, which would like to be, you know, all the signal going into the open connector, has nowhere to go, and it's all going to be reflected. That's a good approach. Take that insertion loss that you make with that measurement and divide by two. Usually that's the cable insertion loss. Let me drop. There's a slight caveat to that. If there's a kink in the cable, a bad connector in the middle of the cable, something else creating a standing wave ratio in the middle of the cable, then you've now got a double reflection characteristic. You've got a reflection from the end of the cable where you've open-circuited. You've got another reflection where the kink in the cable is, or where you've got a not-perfect connector in the middle of the cable. And those two reflected signals coming back down to the shack, depending on the lengths and the frequencies, they can be in phase or out of phase, and therefore their apparent magnitude can be bigger than reality or smaller than reality. So you got to hope there's only one major reflection occurring at the end of the cable when you do the open cable test, which is true most of the time. But put in the back of your mind that occasionally you can be fooled by that one now, Bill. KE2EJ. K2IW. Go ahead, Eric.
And QG setting.
Good evening, Dick. Two things, actually. One was really kind of cool. Took a little while to figure out. This has to do with water and waveguides. It's a lot of fun, especially if you have a dish with J-hook on it, and you've got some water in there sitting in the bottom of the J-hook. When it gets really hot and the water vapor starts to vaporize, and then when it cools down, it makes a puddle with the J-hook. And all of a sudden, the signal goes away. I also had another cable, a piece of Heliac, a piece of 3/4 inch Heliac. Yeah, I think it was 3/4 inch. No, it was 1 inch. And somebody had cut the end of the cable about 200 foot up the tower. So we were checking out that cable, and I couldn't get any signal to pass through it. I put the CDR on it, and it just basically came back. It's like 2 feet from the connector. I pulled the connector off, and I guess maybe a quart of water came pouring out of it. So, let me get a drop.
By the way, Eric, give us a little bit more audio.
So, when we looked at the end of the cable, I figured I'd cut some of it back and see how the foam looked. It was basically a piece of junk, so I just happened to add another tank of nitrogen, and I decided I was going to hook the nitrogen up to it. Trying to blow the water out of it. So after about 2 weeks of nitrogen bubbling through the whole thing, I wound up getting a piece of cable that actually you could step something through. It didn't look like a 60 dB pad anymore. It looked more like a 10 dB pad. Just wanted to throw that out there. But the water in the waveguide was good because nobody could figure it out. Just the extreme variation, this was in the summer, just during the variations in temperature between when it would work perfectly and go away, we finally decided to climb up the tower, pull a hook out of the dish, and sure enough, there was lots and lots of water in there. K2IW, K2J.
And Bill Rickard's eye is going to get to him in a second. And that piece of waveguide is a nice open air. In other words, inside the waveguide, you got a lot of air. On a hot day, the air expands. A rainstorm comes along, you got a lot of water on the outside of the cable. The cable suddenly gets cooled, water contracts and sucks in the air. And the air contracts and sucks in the water. So if you're not pressurizing waveguide to really keep the water out of it, it's a bit of a pain. And that button hook, the question mark shaped piece of waveguide that feeds the dish, is a nice place where water can gather. And boy, water and waveguide can make a huge amount of loss. And so blowing nitrogen through your cable dried it out, but didn't really restore it to a brand new condition. Maybe it's still usable, but not exactly perfect. Keeping water out of cables is rather important. Water is awfully lossy stuff. Makes an extremely good radio frequency dummy load. So B2QGZ, K2LIW, go ahead, Bill.
Okay, W2QGZ. Yep, so a lot of times, at least in the feeds I've worked on, just to talk about Eric's thing real quick, the pressure window for the pressurized line, it was on the feed at the rear of the antenna or at that bulkhead. So in my case, the little Shepherd's hook was not pressurized. The rest of the line was, but so that'll also cause your problem up top. My other comment was, you know, if you have the capability to do a return loss on your transmission line, you more than likely have the ability to do a distance to fault. And that's the second important part of any sweep. So, you know, like your comment about, yes, there could be some other big reflection in the center. So if you sweep it, you know, first for DTF, just to confirm that the end of the cable is where you think it is in a reasonable range. You rule out other stuff in the middle. You'll know you have a big bump up at the end with the DEF, and then you do a return loss, and you'll get your value.
Not too many of the guys I'm talking to right now, including me, do not own a time domain reflectometer, do not own instrumentation that can give you distance to fault. That's a nice piece of instrument, but one of the people that are pretty well equipped, Bill and Eric, have access to that kind of test equipment. And of the 400 members of this club, I'll be amazed if more than one or two others have got the ability to lay their hands on one of those without making a real good loan from somebody that's got a lot of test equipment. So, cables are fun, Joe. W2LYY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, they offer, but I don't know if you initially answered my question. I was asking where if you add artificially insertion loss into, say, a jumper die at the high end, as you know, you're looking at it from the bottom end, and you get a return loss of, say, you know, the antenna is supposed to be, say, a 20 dB return loss at resonant frequency, and say at 2 points plus 5 and minus 5 megahertz, it's going to be, you know, minus 10 dB return loss, and you see those things like about maybe 6 or 8 dB less, you know, and that was more negative than what they're supposed to be. Could you use that as an example of having to check the cable further for insurance loss of the entire system? That's the point I was trying to get at with the question. With water in the cable, would it simply break all those points down more negatively all at once? Or would it get, where it tend to flatten out your pattern across the entire frequency that you're sweeping? Back to you.
Assuming the cable has only one fault, water in the foam somewhere, for instance. Or water in the foam with only one fault, you don't have two reflected signals beating against each other, creating an interferometer in phase and out of phase. In that case, the insertion loss of the water tends to be very flat. You get a certain amount of loss between 420 and 450, so to speak, megahertz. It'll be almost the same. Yeah, you'll measure a significant difference between 2 meters and 450, but it'll be relatively flat, that insertion loss. If you know for sure that your particular antenna has a 20 dB reflection coefficient in the center, and plus or minus 5 megacycles, it goes down to 10, and then you measure the insertion loss of your, you measure the return loss of your total cable plus antenna, and plus or minus 5 megs, that's a very strong clue as to what's going on with the cable. However, if you haven't really measured that antenna yourself at plus or minus 5 megs and measured the real insertion loss, the manufacturer has told you a specification, and he's telling you the worst case, and he's telling you it's going to be a 10 dB reflection coefficient instead of a 20 in the center, at 10 dB at plus or minus 5 megs. That's his specification, and he's got to manufacture it with some margin. He may have really made it minus 13, not minus 10, at plus or minus 5. And therefore, you can be confused. So unless you really measure that antenna, your example, plus or minus 5, I'd be a little bit reluctant to use that. I would use it, but I'd be skeptical as to how accurate the result is. Does that make some sense, Joe? To me, to LYY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I follow you. Well, the point I was trying to get at, the water is uniformly across the whole frequency band of operation, and then some, plus or minus, it has the same insertion loss. So from what I gather, it would tend to bring your whole pattern down by the additional insertion loss you see at the base station end of the transmission line. Instead of seeing minus 20 in the center frequency, you maybe see minus 23 or 26. And you might think, well, that the antenna is really, really good, though. It looks like a really good reading. Well, maybe you have additional insertion loss. And if you saw your other points be also 3 or 4 dB down, or even more than that, 5 or 6, it would maybe even give you an indication you have to take the thing apart and look and see if you actually are measuring something that's true or not. Back to you, Dick. That's the end of my question.
From what you've just said, Joe, I can tell you've got the concept. You've got the right information. So measuring cable loss when it's a distributed loss throughout a length of cable like water in the phone in the shack, it's not easy to confirm. And you just found some of the ways that maybe you can confirm it, but you might want to use a backup system, like really opening up the end of the cable or really measuring the end-to-end insertion loss of the cable. So good luck with those experiments and studies, Joe. Joe number two, KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey. Go right ahead, Joe, K2LIW, the tech man.
Yeah, roger that. I guess it's an easy question. On HF, I noticed a lot of people talk about a lot of different stuff, like, let's say, about politics and about their personal health problems and whatnot, and maybe sports and so forth. My question to you, Dick, is on 2 meters, on 2 meters, is there a limit what we could talk about on 2 meters? That's my question. Back to you.
Sort of a yes and a no, I think, is the answer to that one, Joe number two. Depends on the particular club. I would believe that most clubs that have a repeater would like you to keep the material discussed over the repeater to be fairly non-controversial. Don't get too heavy into politics. Go very slow on religion. These are delicate subjects for some people. And to discuss a whole lot of your own personal health problems and whatever, most clubs running a repeater don't want to hear that. Just the fact that the repeater sounds nice and quiet during the day and you've opened up a conversation with your buddy and you make believe nobody but you and your buddy are talking to each other is very naive. In a club like this one with its 400 members, some significant number of people are listening, and if they hear you with the very personal information, they're going to be offended. They're not going to like it. The majority of them are not going to like it. So over a repeater, you got to be awful careful with that kind of stuff, from my point of view. Check with the management of your repeater to find out how far you can go with that. Now, if you're having a private QSO on a simplex channel, you've got a hell of a lot more freedom. To a small degree, you can even use a relatively strong language. And talking a one-to-one on a simplex frequency, you can go a lot further. In that case, the only people controlling your transmitter is the Friendly Candy Company, the FCC. And they don't want profanity. However, you can use some pretty strong language. You can go pretty deep into politics, pretty deep into religion, if you're on a simplex channel. And as long as the people in your neighborhood don't start throwing rocks at your house, most likely all's well. In the case of HF, though, again, you've got a
repeater. Time out.
If you're on 20 meters, where your signal is covering thousands and thousands of square miles, there I would be kind of careful with what language I use and what delicate subjects I go into. Because now a hell of a lot of people are listening. But a simplex channel on VHF, UHF, I think that's the place where you have the greatest amount of freedom from my point of view. Maybe not everybody's going to agree with that. Love you, Joe. KC2QIW. Drag your feet in case anyone else wants to add their comments on this one. K2RIW in the tech net.
Do it, Jay.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, most defeated, especially this one, we tend to want to keep it family-friendly, okay? But, as you said, on a simplex frequency, you can pretty much do what you want. Just avoid this, if you've ever seen George Carlin and his deal about the seven dirty words, it also applies to us. But you can imply meaning. There's no problem with that. But again, a large organization, even a small organization, there's generally operational etiquette. Usually they publish it on their website. So when it comes to big repeaters, there you really want to watch out and follow the rule. I mean, we currently have some folks that don't, and it's getting a lot of people upset. So, KTRIWK, thanks.
Urinary interest, AC2IS.
Go right ahead, Bill.
I've probably made my entire comment already, but you overlooked not doing business on the air. Non-pecuniary interest, AC2IS.
Yeah, there's a specific FCC rule. You're not supposed to be using ham radio for anything that creates a cash flow. There's a slight exception to that, and that is when they first started establishing phone patches on repeaters, people would occasionally use the phone patch to call their favorite pizza shop to place an order for a pizza. And that was a gray zone, depending on who ran that particular repeater as to whether or not that was all right. I think the FCC didn't give you a lot of flack on that because you weren't creating profit for the ham radio operator. You weren't creating a cash flow. You were using it in a way that represented a cash flow. But the worst-case situation, of course, is if you use your ham radio in order to dispatch taxi cabs. You're running a taxi cab company, and for whatever reason, you buy ham radio equipment in order to talk to your drivers. Definitely bad news. Over to you, Joe number two, KC2QIW, K2IW in the TechNet.
Roger that. Yeah, that's good to know. My inner circle of friends, we come to think about it, we're not really into politics, and we're not into any religion. We just believe in God, I guess, but we don't have, like, that's funny to come to think about it. And I have all different types of friends from different backgrounds. We're all into, like, extreme sports that we all do together, and into musical bands, and we all play instruments and whatnot, and it's good to know, yeah. So, one last question. I notice people try to sell their radio equipment over the frequencies, is that, like, that's not, like, business, is it? Like, try to... Like, say if you want to, like, try to sell HF radio or amplifier, that's my next question.
If I was the company Ham Radio Outlet, HRO, and I get on to the ham radio frequencies, and I say, hey, we're having a sale this week on the so-and-so transmitter, that's in violation. I mean, you are really running a business, and you're using the ham radio to promote that business. That's bad. But you and I, having signing into the swap and shop, and we don't usually do it, but occasionally guys will do a little bit of haggling. It's a private sale of ham radio equipment between two ham radio operators, and neither of them are in the business of selling or fixing ham radio equipment. And discussing the price over the air, I think, is legal. I think it's perfectly all right. So, a private sale, no problem. But if I'm running a business, whether it be radio repair or sales and service of equipment, then that should not be handled over ham radio, is my belief on that. Let's see if Eric agrees on that one. KE2EJ, K2LIW, go ahead, Eric.
K2RW, K2J. Well, if you happen to be a person who fixes ham radio for a living, that's a problem. Actually, even though you may not mention it, it's still a problem. Because people know that that's what you do, and they'll ask you if you can fix it, blah, 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 stuff like that. And it's really the responsibility of the guy who's the repair guy to respond in a way, say, if you go up. It was incidental that there was music playing, so, you know, that was allowed for that specific type of operation. But as a general rule, anything that's going to, let's say I'm in the radio repair business and I'm going to make some money off you, I can't do that on the air.
But if you happen to be my friend and I say, hey, I saw that HRO is having a sale and they're selling this, and I see $9,200 for X amount of dollars, that's okay, because you don't work for HRO, and you're just passing along information that you experienced. HRIW is being suggested.
Good to know, Eric. Now, what happens if I'm a ham radio operator and I'm known to do a lot of ham radio repairs? So I'm now telling people I'll fix that for you. However, I'm a very gregarious guy and I do it for free. I'm fixing ham radio operations. I'm a repair guy, but because for my club members, it's just one of the services I do, I repair it for free. You and I know somebody who does that. No real cash is flowing. So even though I'm known to be a ham radio repair person, because there's no cash flowing, I think there's no problem with that one. See if you agree. K2EJ, K2IW.
Now, if you make your living repairing ham radio stuff, there's something wrong with you if you're going to fix somebody's radio for free. It's really a gray area. I've heard some stories in California and a few other places where some folks have gotten little letters. It's kind of a hard gray area. It's more how you word things and how you present them. The fact that it might be known that you do this for a living tends to make it even harder. So, I mean, I don't do it for a living, but I do help other people out. So, if you have a ham club, you know, one of you guys has a problem with the transmitter, well, bring it over. We'll take a look at it. That's okay.
K2UPS.
Okay, Rich, K2UPS. You might be mobile. And for the fun of it, please tell us, are you in Ohio? Are you in Pennsylvania? And tell us your opinion on this subject, Rich. K2Uncle Papa Sierra, K2LIW.
Good evening, this is Case of UPS Mobile, and I'm in West Virginia, Neil Wheeling, West Virginia, heading back to New York. Two comments, one on what topics you should or shouldn't discuss. If there's any doubt in your mind or if you're questioning yourself, like, gee, should we discuss this? Better err on the side of caution and just don't discuss it. And also keep it all interesting for general people, and I'd be even careful on simplex because you never know how far that signal's going to go or who else is listening, and issues can arise. And then as far as what denotes sales, you may not be in the business, say, of radios, but let's say you make in your garage wooden call sign plaques, or you produce, three-element, two-meter beams cheap, and you're selling those, that can't be discussed either. That's not like a swap-and-shop item where you just have an old radio and you're looking for something. But, you know, you don't necessarily have to be in the business of it, but even if you just do it as a sideline, I wouldn't discuss that stuff. K2UPS.
HKND with
one
comment.
Go right ahead, Rich.
Hey, this is Kate Jacoby. I did at one point ask through the ARRL, Official Observer Program, how things like that might be handled. And what they had said at that level was, if you are in a business, you can refer someone to your website. Say no more than that. You simply say, my website is xyz.com, and then that's it. You've given out a fair piece of information. It's up to the individual to do the research. Do not get into anything other than that, and that is an interpretation from the ARRL.
Okay, I thank you, Rich number two. Rich number one, K2UPS. If as a sideline, I'm building wooden coal letter plaques in my garage, so to speak, and I build a couple of these per year, and I sell them to my ham radio buddies, and I happen to mention that over the air, I'm deep into the gray zone of running a quasi-commercial business and creating a cash flow. but it's really small time. It's not a great big factory, if you know what I mean. If I do that on a simplex channel, who is the victim? K2UPS, K2LIW?
You mentioned that it's in a gray area. I tend to see more stuff like that as black and white. Either you do it or you don't do it. Not like, well, you can kind of get away with this a little bit. That's just not the way I see certain things. I agree with you. Maybe nobody's going to get hurt by it, but still, I mean, when you look at the rules state, you know, if it's, if you're producing anything, whether it be 1 a year or 100 a year, and that's my interpretation of that particular rule, you shouldn't discuss it. But that's just the way I look at it.
N2MB.
N2MB, K2RIW. See how you think on this one. Barry, go ahead, Barry.
Okay, I think the way that should be handled is, I understand you're allowed to give your phone number out. So if somebody wants to discuss something like that, you certainly can give them your phone number. Even if you're in business, you can give them your phone number and say, look, let's discuss this on the phone. Then it's off of ham radio.
That does sound like a safe solution. Or, this is my website. So let's communicate by email, by telephone. But when it comes to things that I'm selling, and I'm discussing the prices, and potentially cash is going to flow, it sounds like that should not be over ham radio. And with any further comments on this, give me your call letters right now. K2LIW. I think we got most of the flavor on that one, Joe. KC2QIW, K2LIW.
Yeah, Roger that. Yeah, that's good to know. That's good to know, and you learn something new every day. You learn something new every day, and I have another question, but yeah, I'll wait until next week. I'll pass it over to the other station over there, and love you guys, and back to you, Dick.
We're a little bit late tonight, Joe. A relatively small number of people checked in, so give us your second question. Go right ahead, Joe, number two.
Hey, Roger. I'll be really, really quick. A buddy of mine, well, he doesn't live around here, but, you know, I met him on HF, and he sent me a QSO card. He lives near where people do, what's that called, power shooting, fly suit, like they fly in the suit. And they'll be flying in the air, and then after a while, they'll pull the string, and the parachute pops open. I think they're called base jumpers, or people that jump out of the airplane. Okay, my quick question to you, Dick, is what happens if one of those guys gets tangled up in one of the towers that's on your property and chokes them out? Or it could be like a dipole antenna or a tower antenna, and let's say the guy goes... power shooting or base jumping, and you know, he goes into your property and he gets choked out with one of your antennas on your property. Now, can they turn around and say, hey, if your antenna wasn't there, I'll still be alive? So back to you, Dick.
D2IS info.
Go right ahead, Bill.
What he's talking about could be called base jumping. I guess he's not really talking about the specific case, but what he's describing is called wingsuit flying. People, quote-unquote, fly forward about 3 feet for every foot they drop. So they're not able to fly upwards, and by the time they get down to any place where there'd be an antenna, I would think, unless you've got an antenna on a cliff side or something where they're flying past, because they do like to fly low to the ground in those circumstances. In other cases, if you're on flat, pretty much flat ground, they should have been on a parachute for a long time. So you can consider them to be a parachutist at that point. AC2IS.
Thank you, Bill. Andy, as I see it, a person is doing space, doing base jumping. He knows he's in probably the highest risk hobby that you and I can think of. If he climbs up a radio tower, for instance, and jumps from it, 99% of the time, he's violating the rules of the owner of that radio tower. He didn't have permission to do that. If he's jumping from a bridge, he didn't have permission from the authority that owns the bridge to do that. In most cases, these base jumpers, the very first step of their operation, in many cases, is illegal. And therefore, if in the process they carry out their process and they get injured, for them to have a real leg to stand on to sue you, I don't think they're going to succeed. As a ham radio operator with the right zoning permit, I can have a radio tower in my backyard with guy wires, and if somebody flies into my backyard and hits that guy wire, he took that risk. I mean, the FAA rule, for instance, you're not supposed to be flying a motorized aircraft at less than 500 feet of altitude over a residential area. Whether or not they carry out those rules on a ultralight, I'm not quite sure, but on a real aircraft, your Cessna 150 or 182 or whatever, you're not supposed to be below 1,000 feet over a residential area. That's supposed to be below 500 feet over a non-residential area. So in order for him to get himself and that craft into my yard, let me drop it. He's broken some rules. So if your wife says, I don't want you putting a radio tower in the backyard with guy wires because I'm afraid that somebody with his winged suit is going to come flying into it and be injured, I don't think that's a reasonable thing to worry about. It shouldn't be happening. He shouldn't be there. And he's breaking a bunch of rules to take the first step to even have the ability to get there, if you know what I mean. That's the way I see that, Andy. KD2, MTP, K2RIW, oh, wait a minute, that's Joe, KC2QIW, sorry about that. Go right ahead, Joe number two.
D2L with a legal perspective.
Go right ahead, Mr. L.
Okay, so Dick, what you've articulated there, I think, is half of the picture, which is called assumption of risk. If you go out and you do something phenomenally dangerous, and you get injured in a way that people would kind of expect to occur when you go out and you do something phenomenally dangerous, then you are said to have assumed the risk. So if you are jumping off of a cliff, you have assumed the risk, in a sense, of running into things, impacting things, and otherwise getting hurt doing that. There's another component of this, which is whether you have, in some sense, committed negligence as the antenna owner or the tower owner. And in that case, the first question when you talk about negligence, I'm going to drop. The first question is, did you have a duty to this person? And then the next question is, did you breach that duty? So here what we're talking about is a relationship, essentially, between you and the rest of the world. Right? If you have a sidewalk, you have a duty to keep it clear. Well, some places you do, some places you don't. You know, do you have to shovel? Do you have to put down salt? Those are questions that, you know, different states and jurisdictions take different perspectives on. But if the question is, do you have a duty to people falling out of the sky to make the ground as comfortable for them to hit as possible, I think everybody would pretty much agree no property owner has that duty. It's not a reasonable thing to expect you to have to prepare your property for people plummeting out of the sky. So in that sense, I don't think that there would be any finding of negligence on the part of the property owner or the antenna owner. So that you've got two parts there. One, the base jumper or the parachutist has assumed the risk of the injury. And two, you have no duty to that person to make their landing comfortable. And so even if they get hurt falling out of the sky onto your antenna, I don't think you would, a court or a jury would find you negligent.
Thank you, Ed. That sounds like some darn good information. So therefore, I guess I shouldn't lose a whole lot of sleep about the fact that I've got 100-foot of tower in my backyard, and somebody could, in theory, fall out of the sky, so to speak, and hit my tower or hit its sky wires. I have no duty to guarantee that he lands softly if he does this unusual thing that's unexpected by a reasonable person, that he's going to come crashing into my yard. I know I've used a non-technical language on this, but am I at least close, Ed? KB2L, K2LIW, the TechNet?
Yes, and I should put in the standard disclaimers of, you know, I'm only a lawyer here in Buffalo, that maybe out in Guam or something, they have a different perspective on what's reasonable and what kind of duties exist. And I should also say that I haven't, you know, gone out and searched the case law, so I can't say with 100% certainty that I'm correct. But these are generally the principles of negligence law. And so I you know, just trying to apply them as a reasonable person here, I think you're pretty safe.
Okay. So therefore, in theory, I can fill up my backyard with towers and antennas and wires and all kinds of spikes for station master devices and whatever, so that anybody falling out of the sky into my backyard is likely to get injured. And in theory, I might be all right. Over to you, Joe. KC2QIW, K2IW in the TechNet. And out of curiosity, is it really a radio tower you were worried about injuring the guy, Joe?
Yeah, roger, roger. I was on YouTube and I was watching those guys flying in their wing suit. I think that's what it's called. And I could have sworn I saw some antenna towers out there. So that's how I came up with the question. Oh, yeah, by the way, Dick, do you need to put a blinking light on your tower? That blinks, you know, like a safety light, whatever you call those type of blinking lights. Back to you, Dick.
Anything over 200 feet?
Yeah, as Eric just told us, the FCC and FAA rules is that at 200 feet and above, yes, there's got to be a red and white paint on the tower, alternate stripes, and a light on the top. And that light's got to be operating all night long. But below 200 feet, at a reasonable distance from an airport, I think no kind of painting or lighting is required. See if Eric agrees with that. KE2EJ, K2IW in the TechNet.
K2IW, K2EJ. Yes, that's correct. Actually, there's a zone around airports. I don't remember the distance. I think it's like 5 miles. And it changes according to how far away you are from the airport. But actually, today, you no longer have to paint your tower FAA colors if you have a daylight strobe and nighttime flash, which actually is now an environmental thing for the birds, because they found that constantly glowing red lights and flashing red lights that have a long duration, longer than a second, has a tendency to do two things. The birds tend to hit the tower, and the other thing that it does is it affects their navigation. When the World Trade Center was up, and we lit that stick up in the middle of the North Tower, you could go on the roof at any time at night and find dozens of dead finches on the top of the roof because they just fly right into the damn antenna. So, yeah. And actually, Billy just changed one of his towers now. He's changed the lighting system. We'll no longer hear that interference at night on the UHF. And I got something else to talk to you about, Dick. K2IW, K2J.
I'm going to pass it right back to you for that other thing you want to talk about, Eric, but run that by again. With the right kind of strobe lights on my tower that's more than 200 feet, I no longer have a requirement for the alternate red and white paint on the tower. As I think you said, with the right kind of strobe lighting. And the strobe lighting, I guess, is a lot safer for birds. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
That's correct. With the right kind of lighting, which includes daylight lighting, you no longer need to paint your tower. And a lot of people are doing that because paint your tower, you know, 300 foot, 400 foot...